Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast for Friday, October 11th, 2019. On today's episode, we'll hear from Abha Nath, an investor at Wonder Ventures on early stage startups and investing in Los Angeles. The Friday Coffee Meetup Podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid, sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid, sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Now, here's Abha Nath with this week's presentation.
Hi, everyone. Thank you. My name is Abha Nath. I work with Wonder Ventures, which is an early stage venture fund based in Santa Monica. I'm really excited to be here, and I think it's awesome that Pasadena cultivates this community of entrepreneurship. And if at any point you have any questions, feel free to interrupt, and I like to make this interactive. So if you have questions, don't be afraid to interrupt, and we'll go along with the flow. Awesome. So really quick overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to give a brief background on me and on Wonder Ventures and kind of why we focus on pre-seed and LA. Then I'm going to go into Venture Capital 101 from the perspective of an investor, and then how we think about evaluating early stage startups, and then some quick fundraising do's and don'ts, and then we can go into a Q&A. So who am I? I was born and raised in LA over in the South Bay. I actually went to USC and studied industrial systems engineering. And shortly after that, I started my career on the investment team of the Disney Accelerator, which is Disney's corporate venture arm. And it was actually not too far from here over in Glendale. There we were focusing on media and entertainment tech companies. And I joined at a time that they were scaling up their operations, investing in later stage companies. And so we got to invest in some really awesome companies like Savioak, which was a last mile delivery robot, or Epic Games, which is one of the largest gaming companies. And it was a really exciting time because the Disney Accelerator had started off as a partnership with Techstars, where Techstars was identifying early stage opportunities for them. But by the time that I had joined, they kind of started to realize that the most ideal partnerships with startups were actually worth a lot later stage opportunities. So we really got to push the needle on what the future of media and entertainment tech looked like, and it was a really awesome opportunity. I also actually spent a lot of time working on the mobile product strategy with some of our portfolio companies. So at the time, there was a company called Kahoot, which some of you might have heard of. It's an online educational platform. And at the time that they were going through the accelerator, they were looking to launch their direct-to-consumer platform because they traditionally were working on the B2B side and licensing their platform to different schools. Then after that, I wanted to gain a little bit more operating experience, so I joined Ring on the growth marketing team. I was helping manage all our paid social platforms, so Facebook, Amazon, Google, kind of helping develop new ad campaigns and really optimizing to hit certain metrics and continue to improve our conversion rates and certain other growth marketing metrics. It was a cool opportunity. I mean, we were a very lean team. It was a marketing team of three people. One was our CMO who came from the advertising world. He actually used to be a producer at Media Arts Lab. And it was great to have someone who had that creative vision and could kind of drive the brand strategy of the business, which I really think actually helped elevate our business so much. And then it was me and my manager who were focusing on all other marketing channels. And so I was kind of helping with our user acquisition strategy for our consumer products. And for those of you who don't know, Ring has like a whole suite of security products that connect to your mobile device. So their most popular one is the video doorbell. And so I was helping come up with user acquisition strategy for our consumer products. And then also at the same time, we launched a digital app that was called Neighbors, which was intended to be a direct next door competitor. And so kind of coming up with the go-to-market strategy around that. And that was a completely new experience for me, and a lot was learned through that process. Launching a social app is very tricky. You really want to make sure that it's viral and that it does that. You don't have to pay high acquisition costs to get people on your platform. And so there were definitely a lot of learnings throughout that process. After that, I stayed through the acquisition by Amazon, and I got connected to the managing partner of Wonder Ventures, who's Dustin Rosen. And I guess that kind of leads into a good segue into who we are. So Wonder Ventures, as I mentioned, is an early stage venture fund. We like to invest in LA's earliest founders earlier than anyone else. And truly, we mean that. Nothing is too early for us. Kind of the background of the fund gives good context as to why we focus on LA and pre-seed. And so just a quick background. Dustin, the managing partner, prior to starting the fund, he actually ran a company called Pose, which was one of the first mobile shopping companies when the App Store launched. So he grew that company for 6 years, really went through the whole founder journey of day zero to year 1.5 unpaid to hiring 35 employees over in Santa Monica, raising 3 rounds of venture capital, to even selling the company 6 years later. And throughout that whole process, the number one thing that he noticed is that, you know, he had really developed out this network of amazing founders or future founder friends in LA. And their number one complaint was that access to early stage capital in Los Angeles was really difficult, and especially at that time. And compared to more mature markets like San Francisco or New York, there wasn't really as much angel investor capital just free-flowing and kind of available to a lot of startups so that they could start their companies. And so that's kind of where the genesis of Wonder Ventures came from, is really to be the best first-check investor here in LA and to continue to support LA's next generation of founders earlier than anyone else. Today, it's been really awesome. We've gotten the opportunity to support some really amazing entrepreneurs here in LA. Some at companies that you might have heard of, like Clutter, for example, which is an on-demand storage company, or Tala, which is a microfinancing company. And moving into our second fund, which we closed last year in June, and that's actually when I came on board, this is a $15 million fund. We're still continuing to stay at the pre-seed stage and now focusing more of our efforts in the LA tech community. But now we can either lead or co-lead any of the rounds that we invest in. And so we're taking a bigger stake at the pre-seed stage and investing anywhere up to $500K, but making fewer investments per year. So really, we're really excited about that. And something that we really like to say is that we work for the founders, not the other way around. And part of that comes from the empathy that, you know, is core to our ethos, from coming from the operating side first and just understanding or trying to really align with founders. So why LA and why pre-seed? This is probably one of my favorite things to talk about because, I mean, clearly I like LA a lot. I've been here my whole life, which isn't very exciting, but it is what it is. And there's a lot to love about it. I mean, not only the great weather, but there really is this diversity in thought. And I mean, even as I stand here in this room today, it's amazing to see how diverse the LA tech community is in terms of what we're able to cultivate, not only in socioeconomic status, but diversity in background and expertise, which I really think just lends itself to more interesting and more valuable businesses being created. It's also one of the fastest growing economies. I mean, there have been multiple articles in the past years that have cited how LA is the best, now is the best time to be in LA. So it's really exciting for us to see that. And as I mentioned, there's a lack of early stage capital. And part of that comes from the fact that there haven't been major liquidity events for people to have kind of personal wealth to invest into companies, especially from the tech perspective. And so That's why we think it's an interesting time to be in the pre-seed space. And so as these seed funds continue to get larger and larger, we still think that there's a niche and gap in the market that we can continue to fill. And then lastly, there's a unique domain expertise that kind of exists here in LA. I mean, I'm sure a lot of you have experienced firsthand that your friends that don't live in LA think that media and entertainment's the only kind of epicenter here, where there actually is so much more that exists here. For example, the aerospace industry is native to LA. The shipping and logistics industry has a great place here in LA due to, you know, the Port of Long Beach being one of the largest ports and really providing the infrastructure to build a meaningful business in that space. So now a quick overview of Venture Capital 101, which I'm sure you guys all already know about, but it's kind of interesting to talk about it from the perspective of an investor. So the nature of venture capital from the perspective of a funder is that it's a really high-risk, high-reward business. And so we inherently de-risk ourselves by knowing that a majority of the investments we make won't have meaningful outcomes, and specifically from the perspective of an investor. And so that's why there's kind of this huge pressure for investors to really make sure that every investment that we make has a really meaningful outcome. But a meaningful outcome for a venture investor could be significantly different from you as an entrepreneur building your business, and that's why oftentimes, a business doesn't necessarily need financing from the venture capital perspective to be very successful. You can have a $20 million exit, and that's very successful if you own 100% of the business. But when you take venture capital funding and you kind of give up certain ownership stakes, there are different outcomes that are kind of expected from investors. So really being aligned on that, I think, is important as you continue to build relationships with potential investors. So also what that means is not only, it means also that like the earlier that you go, the riskier it is in terms of investment, but also the investments that we're looking to make, we're hoping to be kind of these fund returners. So the initial investment and capital we contribute into the business, we hope to have a 5 to 10x return, usually on the 10x side at a minimum. And a common misnomer is that every business is venture backable, but that's not necessarily true. The intent of it is of venture capital investment is really to help scale and accelerate a business and to really be aligned with these huge market potential businesses so that even if you take a small percentage of the business, it really has a meaningful outcome. And the last thing that I like to reiterate is that every fund is different. A lot of funds have specific focuses in terms of sector or stage. And so as you're considering investment from different investors, it's really important to look into, you know, whether or not there's a great fit in terms of stage, sector. And a lot of times there's great publications that funds post in terms of their thought process on how they invest. And so, you know, doing some research ahead of time is really to your unique differentiated advantage, because you'd be surprised how many people walk into meetings and just don't really have good color or context on that. So now time to talk about evaluating early stage opportunities and kind of how we think about it over here at Wonder Ventures. So the founder and the founding team is definitely the one category that we over-index on. And the earlier you go, it definitely places the most importance, because you don't really have as much data to work with in terms of how you're evaluating a business. So the three things that we're kind of looking for, and these are very high-level categories, but happy to go into them more, are tenacity. So will you and your team really be able to persist through the daily challenges of building a business? And this kind of translates to grit, but also at the same time, what is the chemistry between the co-founding team? How well do you trust each other and how do you know each other? What's the context of the relationship? Someone once put it to me that you have to build a startup knowing that 99 startups out of 100 fail, and you're probably one of the 99, and you still want to build your business, wake up every day, and continue to build your business, which I thought was a great way to kind of think about it. And can you really trust your team to take on that challenge with you? Another thing that I think is super important is founder market fit. So why are you building this company? What unique advantage you have in the space, whether it's domain expertise or being a serial entrepreneur that has built multiple businesses in the past before, that makes you uniquely positioned to kind of win in this space? And I think this is often overlooked, but it really is something that's communicated in multiple meetings, and it's something that we pay a lot of attention to because it kind of goes back to why you'll continue to persist throughout daily challenges. And then the last thing is kind of like the magnetic force that founders have. And it's obviously a lot of these things are intangible, but you try your best to kind of get a good understanding of this. And what I mean by that is, what is your natural charisma as a founder? Because at the end of the day, you're selling your business to everyone. You're selling your business to potential employees that you can recruit, to investors, to potential customers. And so do you have that natural ability to kind of sell people on the larger vision of the business, but still be able to focus on the short-term goals in order to execute on that larger vision? The next most important thing is market size. Yeah, what's up?
What do you think about solo founders?
Yeah. Obviously, great businesses have been built with solo founders. I think that having a co-founding team that has like a diversified skill set is obviously to an advantage. It kind of just helps you manage a workload in a more balanced way. I won't say that great businesses haven't been built by solo founders, but you know, having someone to kind of share the equal weight in different categories really just helps you continue to build your business. Any other questions? Yeah. Do I personally prefer or Wonder Ventures? Wonder Ventures prefers LA-based pre-seed companies. Those are truly our main categories that we're focusing on. There are certain businesses that we tend to lean into. So we usually invest only in businesses where software is a core component of the business. And we really lean into certain categories like consumer, B2B, and enterprise. If you go on our website, we have a feature where you can kind of sort through our past investments by category, and I think that gives a good high-level overview of the areas we're interested in.
What if it's consumer, but it's not
software? So, like a consumer product?
Real big, yeah.
It's real big?
We'll do Q&A at the end.
Okay, yeah, awesome. Sorry. So at the end, I'll come back to you and answer that question. The market size. So this one's really important, and I touched on this in the past, but when we're investing in businesses, we're really looking for businesses where the potential outcome of the business is large and meaningful, and one of the best ways to kind of ensure that is by going after a business that really has a large vision, right? So a big opportunity. And so what we mean by that is multi-billion, even trillion-dollar opportunities. And so part of the reasoning for that is that as investors, we always think about, if you say that your total addressable market is some number, say $10 billion, we're always looking at what is 10% of that, and that's like the best case scenario of what you would be able to, you know, kind of quick back of the napkin calculations of what you'd be able to take in that market. And so we're always looking for the opportunities that really are those larger out-of-the-box opportunities and opportunities that even create new markets that potentially wouldn't have been thought of before. Another thing that's important is to kind of really come up with what your competitive advantage is as you're building a business. So what's your unique defensible moat? Is it a distribution advantage? Is it a specific technical advantage, like a patent of some kind? Or is it something that, you know, you have some structured sales plan that will really make sure that you win in this space? And that's something that just helps in terms... That's an important thing to communicate to investors because it's something that we're looking for in businesses. So product. So your product has to be sticky, technical, and addictive. So that kind of can sound arbitrary, but the main thing is it really has to be solving a problem that actually exists, right? And it should be this medicine, not a vitamin. I think that's the phrase. But you really want it to be sticky too. So what that means is what... The current solution people, if people use your product as your current solution, their willingness to switch onto a different platform is really high. And so kind of how can you increase the friction from switching onto a different platform by making your product so addictive and so easy to use? So think about just some of the products that you use on a daily basis and what you really like about those and how those features can kind of translate into your own product. And then something that we always love to see is a demo. Even though we're at the earliest stages, if there's some way that you can really translate your vision into a demo, it makes it that much easier for people to understand your product, especially investors. And we think it's a very beneficial way to pitch your business. Okay, and then the last thing that we look for is this phrase called micro traction that Dustin actually coined. And I think that part of this came from just realizing that a lot of times in conversations with seed investors, they kind of come back to you, say, well, we want to see traction. We want to see 100K MRR, various different numbers around traction and metrics to hit. But of course, when you're first starting out as a business, you kind of just can't get to that level without some, you know, initial help or support. And so we kind of broke it down to, we want to see micro traction, maybe not 100K MRR, but what sort of small, repeatable demonstration of the larger scale of the business can you demonstrate to us in order for us to have conviction in your business? And so that kind of really breaks down into three things. The first thing is a small but measurable trajectory of growth. So say you can't hit 100K MRR, but you can find three different, you develop data over time, right? So as you interact with your investors, when you first start out, you can just be pitching a vision and idea and say, you know, like, this is the idea we want to build. We understand it's not a fit right now, but we'll come back to you in a month and show you where the progress has come. After 1 month, you have five customers at $50 a month. And then after 2 months, you have 20 customers. And, you know, after some time, it shows some trajectory that's similar to the trajectory you hope to have of your overall business with scale. And that gives us more conviction of how we can invest in your business. The second thing is you should have a really strong understanding of who your customer is and who your user groups are and the current demographic that you want to be selling your product into. And that this is where a demo is really helpful, especially with a consumer business. If you can demonstrate through a product, even if it's a minimum viable product, of like what you're trying to achieve, it makes it that much easier for someone to kind of understand what you're building. And then the last thing is proving micro customer acquisition. So obviously with a lot of these paid social advertising platforms that exist, to achieve meaningful results, you have to contribute a lot of capital. But what amount of small capital could you contribute to kind of demonstrate whether it's a small scale campaign of, you know, $200 or $500 to demonstrate the similar metrics of LTV or customer acquisition costs or conversion rates, et cetera. The last thing that I want to talk about is kind of fundraising do's and don'ts. These are just some things that I've kind of learned over the past year, or I guess past couple years. And this, by all means, if you have any questions, feel free to follow up with me. But the first thing that we always ask for is to try to get a warm introduction to an investor when you're kind of trying to pitch to them. As you can imagine, especially being as early as we are, we're consistently learning about various different companies. So as much as you can, try to find a way to find a mutual connection to an investor so you can get your foot in the door and kind of get ahead of the investor in that way. The second point seems kind of obvious, rehearse your pitch with your co-founder, but more deeply what I meant about that is kind of make sure that your chemistry with your co-founder is right when you're pitching. So have a clear division of labor over which sections you guys are going over. So if your CTO wants to go over product and the technical aspects and you want to go over the vision, et cetera, make sure that's clearly defined because, for example, a lot of times we'll go into pitches and we'll hear co-founders talking over each other and it just gives a bad impression. This seems obvious, but definitely it's an important thing to think about. Another thing is to keep your slide at a minimum of 10, or at a maximum of 10 to 15 slides for your pitch deck. I think that anything longer is a little too verbose, and I think to be able to clearly communicate your vision, a short amount of slides is a really powerful strength. In your actual fundraising conversations with investors, make sure to keep it conversational. One of the hugest turnoffs is when you're in a pitch meeting and it can be a one-sided conversation. The best way to engage investors is kind of to really make it a conversation, include them, and that's just a more meaningful way to have that conversation. The next thing is to have a strong understanding of financials and metrics of your business. You know, a lot of times we'll ask various different companies, like, oh, what were your sales numbers for the last month? And people will kind of fumble a little or be like, oh, I can email you afterwards. You know, it's really important to have a strong understanding of these things because it is another vote of confidence that you're the best person to build this business and that you truly understand what's happening on a day-to-day basis. Be able to demonstrate clear focus, but also a larger vision. So you really want to be able to sell the larger vision of your business, but also demonstrate how you can focus on the short-term actionable things to kind of get to that level. After your pitch, write down every question that an investor asks you. I know this seems very tedious, but we've actually found this to be very helpful. Even as our companies continue to raise at the growth stages, just writing down every question that an investor asks you, because investors tend to ask a similar circuit of questions, and so being able to rehearse that is just great practice. Pitch in the active voice, not in the passive voice. So don't say, our goal is, say, we will be doing this by March or et cetera. Be honest about your competition. So often I ask companies, you know, who they identify as their closest competitors, and they say that no one exists in the space. And obviously that's not true, and that also wouldn't be a healthy business to be building. So really be able to clearly communicate who your competition is, but also why you're better and why you have a unique advantage against them. As a lot of times in conversations with investors, they'll offer to make intros to you. And the number one thing you should do is follow up on those intros. One, it's the best way to, you know, at zero acquisition costs, you know, get a conversation with a potential customer, and it demonstrates your follow through and your ability to kind of, you know, succeed as a founder. And lastly, be gracious in all of your interactions. I know that one of the most frustrating parts of this process is to hear no, and we truly empathize with that, but, you know, it really goes a long way to really be diplomatic with how you receive feedback, and investors remember that and really appreciate that as well. And I think that was all that I had planned, so now we can move into the Q&A.
Trade microphones here for you. I got you another water down there too.
Thank you so much. That was amazing. So much insightful information at the very end. That was fantastic. I love your advice on not saying we don't have any competition. That's fantastic. Okay, so we're going to open it up to Q&A. We're going to pass the microphone. I'm going to hand it off to John. This is a great time to ask about what fundraising is like, how to approach investors, what the LA scene is like. This is not really a good time to tell a story of why you chose LA to start your startup, or if she'll invest in your startup. This is not the right time for that. So,
did you want to ask your question about consumer products and software?
Hi, thank you for the presentation.
Yeah, of course.
I have a device, a consumer device, automotive, and potentially very lucrative, and I need help with it. It's going to be a big launch, and I just wanted to know, it's not software related. It has a software component to it that drives it. However, it's not doesn't go on your desktop. It's a product, and I wanted to know how, if I came to your group, how you would look at it.
Yeah, that's a very great question. Is this on?
Yeah.
It is? Oh, okay. yeah, that's a very great question. We tend to stay away from businesses that don't have software as a core component just because of our backgrounds in terms of what we feel like is our expertise and what we can lean into and strategy. And that doesn't mean that it's not a great business. It could still be a very successful business. And that's why I think like really finding that alignment of like which venture funds kind of have the same interests is really important. But that's just how we think about it. I will say, though, that we truly do, you know, try to evaluate every opportunity that comes to us that fits in that LA pre-seed category. So a lot of times people will still send us e-commerce companies and we'll still take a look because, you know, we're not going to pass up the next greatest opportunity just because of that. But we do kind of have a focus.
Over here.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for the presentation. It was really informative. I have two questions. In terms of the funding mechanism, are you guys, because you're pre-seed, are going through convertible notes? And if so, how has that recent issue with TopTal not converting their notes because they don't raise later on? How have you guys kind of like tackled that issue, if you have or are thinking about it? And then secondly, do you guys set aside a portion of your fund for follow-on, or do you traditionally follow-on?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We actually only do priced rounds, and part of the reasoning for that is we really like to have a clean cap table, and we really like to have a strong understanding of who owns how much when we're investing into the company. In terms of how much we allocate for follow-on, about a third of our fund is allocated towards follow-on, and yeah, that's kind of how we structured it.
Since you're dealing with early stage companies and in some cases pre-seed, what would you like to see the entity as? So if I got together with a couple of people and say, hey, here's a really great idea. Let's go ahead and start this company and we need to raise some capital. What would you suggest that we do before we approach your firm or some other VC firm?
Yeah. In terms of like the legal side of creating a company or?
Yes. Well, the entity that you're going to be investing in.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of us getting together to start up a company, but we haven't formed a company. Then how are you going to invest in that?
Yeah. So the unique position that we're in is that we invest. Nothing is too early for us. So we've invested in two co-founders before that we felt have had strong conviction before they've actually incorporated or before they've taken the steps to actually form a business. And then we've also invested in businesses that have had, you know, meaningful traction, 10K MRR or what have you. And it kind of just varies. I would say if you're at the stage where you haven't fully formed a team, we're open. I mean, if we get a warm introduction to a group of people, we like to meet people early. And so we're open to like brainstorming sessions and how we can help you navigate the first questions around building a business and thinking about strategy. But it really kind of just varies on what you're thinking about, whether it's aligned with some of the investment theses we have. And as much as you can do to kind of prove that micro traction, whether it be identifying your customer groups or having some sort of unique distribution structure thought of ahead of time, that's what you can do to be best positioned.
So in that case, it sounds like that you would actually write a check to the individuals and doesn't really have to be an entity already formed.
Yeah, it really does depend. So if it's a serial entrepreneur that we know has had great success at building and scaling multiple businesses before, we don't need them to be a formal entity, for example. That's just one instance. But overall, we try to kind of we like to see companies that have done as much as possible to prove out their business ahead of time through micro attraction, as we had mentioned. And also, Dustin wrote a more lengthy piece on that. If you any of you are curious, you can just look up Dustin Rosen micro attraction on Medium and find out more.
Sorry, I got another follow-up question to that. What about the use of funds then? What are you guys looking for and how they're going to use that money that is being invested in the company?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. A lot of it will be to kind of get to where seed investors are looking to evaluate your company, right? So how can you test out certain marketing channels to see what your different metrics are? How can you hire the right people to bring your team together? Because we feel like that's also a very important advantage, is having a tech team, for example, that's close to you. And it really just depends on the company, but those are some of the most common use cases of funding.
Hi, I have two questions. One, For let's say $500K, how much equity do we take on average? I know it's negotiable, but what's an average for $500K equity-wise for VCs?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We invest anywhere. We traditionally, our investment range falls between 250 to 500K, and we're looking to own 10% of the businesses we invest in.
Okay. Second question, you said about knowing your competitors. Who would you say are other VC, new VC firms in LA that we should know about?
Well, shout out to Minnie at 10110. You guys probably all know her. It feels like she's been in LA for the last 15 years. 10110's great. They focus on really deep tech, and they do seed stage investing. Amplify is a fund that we really like to work with. We also really like bringing strategic angel investors into rounds, and so sometimes we'll fill the syndicate once we've set the terms and led the round with strategic angel investors that are operators. And this is actually something I should have included, but having angel investors come into your round at the earliest stages is sometimes very beneficial because they have a lot more at stake. It's their personal capital that they're contributing into the business. And when they have a specific skill set, they're much more willing to contribute that to ensure the success of your business, especially in that earlier round. So it's sometimes great to really bring around angel investors.
Back here.
Oh, hi, my name is Cindy, and I'm wondering, do you have any tips or tricks for how to figure out who your competitors are at super early stages? Because I just don't see how that happens. If everybody's got an idea and there's no platform to post these things, how do you even find out if anybody else is already doing this?
Yeah, I think Crunchbase is a great resource to kind of get a high-level overview. And so even what you can do, they have some great features where you can search by industry or sector. So say if I wanted to build an ed tech company, I could either search for ed tech companies or ed tech investors and then kind of just combing through the investments. Sometimes even looking up specifically like what your company is trying to build. So if you were trying to build the next Uber, you could just look up like transportation rideshare platforms, and there are very elementary ways to just search on Google and Crunchbase and find out randomly a lot of information about the competition. But I think Crunchbase is a great resource, AngelList also, and sometimes even LinkedIn, you can just browse through certain keyword searches.
Back here, wrap up.
Do you connect startups with technology service providers? And what is this your strategy to help them get the most value for your investment?
Yeah, could you repeat the question?
Do you connect startups with technology service providers?
Mm-hmm.
And what is your strategy to get most back from your initial investment?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if I think I understood your question correctly, we've built out a whole platform for the companies that we invest in to kind of help them get fast-tracked to certain relationships with different service providers. So that can be anything from AWS to Microsoft to even relationships with certain law firms around LA that kind of know to treat our companies well. How we expect to get the best out of our investment. A lot of it is we really invest in the founders and kind of their backgrounds and their and what their expertise are. And we always say we work for the founders, not the other way around. So we're not going to tell you how to run your business. At the end of the day, you're the most uniquely advantaged to build your business. So how can we support you in other ways tangentially to kind of help lift you up? And we're really open to like listening to that feedback and supporting you in that capacity.
Hey.
Hi.
Looking 5 or 10 years out, where do you see the most opportunities for entrepreneurs in LA?
Yeah. If I knew, I would build a business and tell you. But I don't know. I think I personally am very fascinated in the shipping and logistics industry. I think that there's a lot of room for infrastructure to be built there. I mean, it's a very pen and paper run process, which is kind of crazy to think about, and especially as we think about just general trends of increased consumerization and how, you know, we all love our two-day prime shipping, and I think I just saw a billboard for one-day prime shipping now available in LA. What does that actually mean from, like, how a product is actually getting from, you know, the actual manufacturer to our houses? What sort of distribution centers are required? What sort of actual transportation infrastructure is required to optimize that? So that's kind of a space that I've personally been really interested in.
Hi. Well, that kind of answers part of my question. One of the other question I have was, is there a portfolio company that in your firm that you're really excited about their growth that they're having right now? And then when you do make decide to make an investment in a new company, do you and Dustin have to agree on it? Or is there like you make ones and he makes ones and bring them in? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms of a portfolio company that I'm really excited about, it's really hard. I mean, I spend so much of my weeks with all of the active ones, and so you kind of have an allegiance to all of them. I think one company that's been really exciting for me personally that I've witnessed most recently that comes to mind is a company called Honeybee Health that's looking to make generic prescription medications more affordable for Americans, and so just has a feel-good mission, and they've been experiencing tremendous success, so it's been exciting to support their mission. And then what was your second question again?
How you make investment decisions.
Oh, got it. Yeah, awesome. So we both have the ability to act kind of independently, but we, you know, every Tuesday we get together and kind of review the companies that are in our pipeline and have an investment committee of sorts and kind of discuss all the companies that we're looking at. And so we have a very healthy discussion about, you know, every company and the consideration that goes into each investment that we make, but we do have the ability to veto each other's decisions.
Back here, Eva.
Thanks for the, this is really loud. Thanks for the presentation. You know, there's this old cliche phrase that your net worth is your network. And so I'd love to know if there are any events that you really like to go to, other than this one, where you can meet entrepreneurs and then vice versa, where entrepreneurs can go to meet investors.
Yeah. So there are a lot of different events that I actually really like. I mean, before I got into the tech scene, when I was actively looking to join the tech scene, I felt like LA did a great job of not only hosting events, but hosting free events, which I think is usually rare to find in other tech ecosystems. Tech Day LA is, it already happened like a couple weeks ago, but it's basically a conference that happens in downtown LA that aggregates a bunch of like the hottest tech startups in LA. And you really get the whole gamut. You get the early stage founders, but then you also get more seasoned companies. And the cool thing about the seasoned companies is they have like their actual operators there. So like people who are VP director level product managers or directors of engineering at tech companies in LA, which I think sometimes is just as uniquely fascinating to network with because they're doing just as much to build the companies. So Tech Day LA I really like. I think that I've tended to focus on like the female focused events, and so I really like the women in tech events that happen around LA. There's a woman in product group, so if any of you are product managers and are looking to join, let me know and I can help you get cued into that network. I also know that on the west side there are a couple different events that happen at like the different office incubator spaces that exist. So Expert Dojo has pitch practices, Stubbs, Alderton, and I'm forgetting what the M is in SA&M, but it's a law firm that has a pre-accelerator and they host events. Startup Boost hosts events. Google's Cloud for Startup office in Venice, they always host events that are open to the public, and that's also a great way to meet kind of the West Side techies.
Back here.
Hi, my name is Matt. I had a question for you. You mentioned that you like to see how your founders are thinking about building out like a tech team for their company. What do you like to see in terms of the thinking about building out their sales team and sales structure early on, particularly with B2B tech companies?
Yeah, it's very important with B2B tech companies for sure. I'd say definitely one of the more important things that we take into consideration. Part of it is what is your overall strategy, right? So how are you planning to penetrate different customers and kind of get them on board, and what structure have you applied to that? So really, this goes back to like the repeatability of your business and what sort of ways can you scale. So as you contribute capital into the business, how does it scale? And so being able to articulate that.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk this morning. I just wanted to ask a question that's kind of in a different stream, but do you have any advice for startup nonprofits and kind of going about angel investors and that way for a, more of a social service, or is that not, like what's, I know there's a lot happening in LA, but LA is so in different areas that it's hard to know where to go if you have an idea for a startup nonprofit that could really benefit a community. Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I don't have a ton of experience with it, truthfully, and so I don't want to stand up here and give you false information. I could definitely try to look into it and see if I can come up with helpful resources for you, though.
Okay. We got a question over here.
Okay. Hi. I was just wondering what type of applications you wish you would see more of, and then what types you currently are seeing like a pattern for right now.
What I wish I would see more. That's a good question. It's hard to say what I wish I would see more. I mean, going back to the shipping and logistics space, I find this space very fascinating. It's not very sexy, but it's definitely a space that I find the most compelling. So I'd love to see more businesses in that space. A lot of the consumer companies, I think you'd be surprised how much groupthink kind of occurs around consumer companies. And so a lot of people think that they have very uniquely thought of ways to build startups in the consumer space, but it turns out that we all tend to think very similarly. So maybe seeing some differentiation in that. But yeah.
One last question. Going back to your days at Ring, so Ring started as a device, Wi-Fi connected device, and I thought one of the things that they did really well was when they started the recurring revenue model and subscription model. Was that something that was initially in the plans, or was that something that you helped develop when you became part of the marketing team?
I did not help develop that. That was after or before my time. But I think one thing that Ring did very well that I can speak to for sure is having the overall vision of where we wanted to go and being able to really think about long-term brand strategy. And so something that we did that was pretty unique to us, since we had this producer that came from Media Arts Lab in the advertising world, is he really pushed us to go into TV advertising earlier than most startups are advised to. And TV advertising is very expensive. And so a lot of startups are very hesitant to go into advertising on that platform because it's hard to track what the actual effects is, right? You can do small scale tests of after you launch a campaign in a certain demographic, you go on your website and check web traffic, but you don't really have meaningful data on how it affects consumers. But the benefit of it is that it creates a brand, and it's a household, it becomes more of a household name once you're advertising on TV as a platform. And so our CMO really pushed us to be creative in the different channels that we were advertising on. And so we got into podcasting relatively early. And we were really just trying to do whatever it takes to just get Ring into people's, at the forefront of their minds. And so we even advertised on different trucks. And so you probably saw that their advertisements were all around LA and around the country. And so we were always thinking about, you know, when you use certain social platforms, you get so hyper-targeted, but it doesn't really allow you to understand what other demographics exist that you could potentially be marketing to that you don't know or identify as customer groups. And obviously your startup has to be at a specific scale to be able to do this, but I think we were really pioneering change in terms of how we thought of our marketing strategy in that way.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com. And get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.